After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, her disclosure of classified documents from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan ushered in the age of leaks. Now, Chelsea Manning has been freed from prison and talks about why she did it and everything that followed. It's Tuesday, June 13th.
Yeah.
We met in New York, and for the time that Chelsea was in New York, she was staying in an apartment overlooking the Hudson River.
Matt Scher recently interviewed Chelsea Manning for the Times magazine.
And the view was almost confined only to water. And I remember that one of the first things that Chelsea said to me in the apartment was that her first night there, she just sat at the window and stared out and thought about where she'd come from and what a strange trip it had been, because she had assumed that she would never be getting out of prison. So to come from that physical and emotional place to being in this box in the sky in Manhattan was obviously a little unnerving for her. But I think she took solace in it too. I mean, she'd set up her Xbox. She was playing Forza, which is a car driving video game.
Oh, cool.
She had pizza in the fridge, and she'd set up near the doors an unplugged microwave, an unused microwave, and everyone who came in threw all their devices into the microwave.
Why?
So there's a Faraday cage, it's called, inside the microwave that blocks radio waves. And for probably good reason, Chelsea has been extremely worried about being tracked, about having her phone and internet and email tracked by hackers.
So when you walk into her apartment, did she ask you to put your cell phone in this microwave?
Yeah, she opened the door and said, "Okay, you got to put it in. You got to put your laptop in and your phone." But then that was so full of devices that I had to put it in the kitchen microwave, my computer, which was still plugged in, and put my phone in there as well. It was surreal. I mean, it really was.
Matt, I think most of us know two things about Chelsea Manning. The first is that many people view her as a traitor, our president included. The second is that she entered prison as Bradley Manning and left as Chelsea Manning. What does she make of the public story of herself?
So I think that there is this sense that Chelsea feels that her narrative, that her story was a very public story and has been grappled over by many different people in many different settings, but that her voice has been missing from it, which is true. So I think although there is a sense of, you know, hesitancy to really engage with this head on, she does want her side of the story out there.
Let's talk about her story. Take us back to kind of the beginning, to her childhood.
So she comes from a town in Oklahoma called Crescent. Her father was conservative. Her mother stayed home with the kids. She had an older sister. And she knew from an early age, even if she wasn't able to describe it because she didn't yet have the vocabulary, that she didn't fit in with the other kids in the neighborhood. She described to me wearing her sister's clothes, trying on her sister's makeup, asking her dad what was stopping her from playing with other girls instead of playing with other boys.
And what did he say?
Well, his answer was, we're physically different. He used the plumbing line. I think he actually used the word plumbing, according to Chelsea. He said, boys are boys and girls are girls, and you live with the body that you're given. When she's in grade school, essentially, she comes out as gay. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just a disaster for her. It was endless teasing at school, and so she tries to take it back, and she can't take it back, and the harassment continues, and she describes this feeling of just isolation, this sheer isolation from the world that she was in. It wasn't until she was even in the military that she could really give a voice to what was happening to her.
So what would lead a person who went through all that to enlist in very masculine-cultured military?
Yeah, well, a lot of different reasons, but I think the underlying reason is that she hoped, pretty tragically in retrospect, that it would man her up.
I think that was influenced by my father. It will make you more of a man, you'll have more structure, you'll have more, you know, it made me a man, just all these like things that he was telling me for all these years kind of sunk into me.
I mean, there's an amazing amount of suppression that was happening all her life.
Yeah, after you know, years and years of this, of him telling me this, I've always kind of felt like a disappointment to him, because I didn't come, you know, I didn't meet his expectations. I didn't become the man that he expected me to be.
And I think anyone who's tried to keep a secret or has tried to push some fact about their lives inside them knows how explosive that can be and how hard. And yeah, look, she enlisted. Her father had been in the military. Underlying all of it was this idea that if I do this, maybe I'll stop thinking that I'm a woman. And then she deploys to Iraq at the end of 2009.
And when she was deployed, what was she actually doing in those early days in the military?
She was trained as an intelligence analyst. So she gets to Iraq and she goes into a secure facility and she sits in front of her computers. And for 10-hour stretches, she's looking at raw intelligence.
And how do we get to the version of Chelsea Manning who is leaking the material that's coming across her screen?
So in a lot of the material that has come out so far about her case, it's often described in terms of epiphanies. And I think that there is some of that, but I think it was also pretty gradual.
Of course it's gradual. Like these things, like you have to be exposed to things over a long period of time. I came into it thinking things would be black and white, and they weren't.
And what starts to happen when she's in Iraq is, some of it is firsthand. Some of it is flying over these areas that she'd only seen in video footage where there was all this wreckage.
When I flew over neighborhoods that I had seen imagery of for 9 or 10 months prior to flying over it.
And some of it is seeing reports from the field that depict a war that starts to feel a little futile.
I knew the landscape so well from the air that I recognize these neighborhoods. I read between 70 and 90 detailed reports first thing on the shift every day. At a certain point, I stopped seeing records and I started seeing people.
She starts to think, okay, look, maybe people need to know about this. She had this extraordinarily sky level view of the conflict in Iraq, and in her thinking she thought, look, it'll change if people can see some of this.
And so how does this actually work, getting the information she's seeing, this kind of sky high view of it all? How does she actually get it out to the world? What did she do?
In February of 2010, she has a leave, and so right before she leaves to go home, she downloads a huge library of files, and then she uploads that to the personal computer that she's planning on taking home with her. Now, at that point, she had not made a decision to leak the documents, but she had them in her possession. So she goes home, and then as far as in her telling, this is the closest that she did come to an epiphany. She goes home, she's riding around the metro in the DC area where she was living at the time.
I was so disappointed. felt like my leave was one of the most disappointing things.
But what was it that was disappointing about the leave?
I didn't get to see my family for a week. They were busy. It felt like I was fighting it, like I was living and fighting and breathing this war, and like it wasn't on people's minds at all. I felt like I was in a foreign country for the first time in my life when I was walking in American streets, and it was bizarre.
And so she initially just tries to approach various newspapers. She tried The Post, she tried The New York Times, and she tried Politico.
Yes, I'm darting around on the metro in D.C. in the cold.
What was it that you wanted to tell these people? I mean, not specific, not what the information was, but what was it that you wanted them to know in a bigger sense?
That there are two worlds. There's the world in America, and then there was the world that I was seeing.
But at that time, this is pre-Snowden, she says, look, no one had the technology to be able to allow me to securely upload these documents, because she doesn't want to be caught yet. So eventually she knew about WikiLeaks, and she said, okay, this site is set up to do this securely. So before she leaves the DC area to go home, she uploads all the significant actions from Iraq and Afghanistan to WikiLeaks, and then she flies back to Iraq.
And just to remind us, what is in the leak? How big is it? And what's the range of files?
It is hundreds of thousands of files. Now, Manning is known for two different types of leaks. She has the war logs, as they were later called, from Iraq and Afghanistan. And then she had the diplomatic files, which were State Department classified data from around the world. And it portrayed the war to a degree that had never been portrayed before. I mean, at the time, you look back and journalists were embedded in the Middle East, and there was sort of the official version of the war. But this was everything, right? This was down to the smallest firefight. And it remains astonishing and complicated. What she ended up leaking was the largest library of classified military documents in history. And I think since there has been nothing larger.
At this point, she's still Bradley Manning to the world. So is she sitting in the military now essentially with two massive secrets in her life?
Yeah, to a degree that even when I was interviewing her about it, about this period in her life, I felt the anxiety. She, at this point now, had settled on the fact that she was a woman, that she knew she was transgender, but she was in a military that did not accept the idea of transgender people. So she's trying to hold that in, and at the same time, she's holding in the fact that she has provided all these documents to WikiLeaks, and they had not yet published them.
From your conversations with her about this, did one of these secrets in some ways influence, maybe even motivate, the other? How exactly do these two secrets intersect?
It's the million-dollar question, and I think that they do intersect. I don't think they're separate. I think that part of what was happening was she was in psychological distress at the time. In her appellate brief, which was filed many years later in 2016, her lawyers make this point. They say, you know, look, if she had had the help that she needed, and then they imply, you know, maybe this might not have happened. Now, I asked her about this because it's a question, you know, that my editor had wanted to know the answer to, and I'd been thinking about it nonstop.
I want to ask you a difficult question, and you may not want to answer, but the in the appeal that Vince and Nancy prepared, they make this kind of implicit argument that if you had had, that you were deprived help, which you obviously were, and counseling, and that you were not getting it, and you should have been getting it, but that if you had gotten help, things may not have played out the way that they did?
I am not willing to speculate on that. What I can tell you is that my values would have been the same. The things that I care about would have been the same. How I would have acted, it's purely hypothetical at that point.
Okay.
If you read between the lines a little bit, that seems to indicate that she feels like she would have done it no matter what, that the psychological distress didn't play a role in it. I think they intersect in a lot of ways, but I do think they are essentially separate struggles that she was experiencing at the exact same time to sort of disastrous personal effect.
Which one, if you can say or have surmised from your conversations with her, which one of these weighed more heavily on her?
Her gender identity. I mean, I think that right before her arrest, she was having conversations with a hacker named Adrian Lamo, who eventually turned her in. That's how she got arrested. And you read back through those chats, and she was sort of defiant about the leaks themselves. At least then she could discuss it. But her transgender identity was something that nobody knew about.
After the break, Chelsea Manning's arrest. We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for the New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made, and then painstakingly to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to the New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
Matt, take us through what happens next. She's caught, right? And then she's arrested. So what happens?
So she's caught in the spring of 2010. She's arrested and taken immediately to a military installation in Kuwait, where she's put in what amounts to solitary confinement.
They kept me in what was essentially a cage. It was a big steel cage, and it had a bed and a toilet, like a cell, but it was just a big steel cage in a tent, and it was so, like, the dust from Kuwait was seeping in, and I couldn't tell from where I was in the cell or in the tent whether it was day or night.
At the same time this is happening, news comes out of her arrest. Now, some information that she published had immediately become public, the infamous helicopter video.
Hotel 26, Crazy Horse 18, have 5 to 6 individuals with AK-47s.
Which was taken from the cockpit of an American Apache in an incident where civilians were killed.
Light them all up.
Come on, fire!
She had leaked that, and that had been published by WikiLeaks, and they'd done some other smaller documents. The diplomatic cables and the war logs are not published until after she's arrested. So she's
I didn't remember it that way.
Yeah, so she goes to Kuwait. She's totally isolated from the world, has no idea what's going on. No one will tell her.
I was completely isolated from the rest of the world. I had no idea what was going on in the rest of the world. I had no idea if anybody knew I was there. I had no idea where I was. Like, I knew I was in Kuwait. I knew I was at Camp Arafjan because they brought me there. But there was a certain point where I was like, I've been forgotten about and I've just disappeared.
And meanwhile, the chat logs are published, which are the conversations that she had with this hacker, Adrian Lamo. Those sort of serve as the inspiration for these writers at The Guardian the London newspaper to reach out to Assange and say, well, in these chats, Manning mentions all these other documents that she took. Are those going to get published? And so later in 2010, Assange, The Guardian, The New York Times, Der Spiegel in Germany work out an agreement where they start to publish the Afghan war logs, and those start to make it out into the public.
In the past month, more than 75,000 Afghan war logs were leaked. Officials called it one of the biggest security breaches in U.S. military history.
She's kept in lockup. She goes from Kuwait to Quantico, and she spends essentially a year at Quantico in conditions that have been likened to torture by a UN investigator.
At any point during that time, were you able to see any snippet of news? Did you have any understanding of what was happening?
No, they put me in a compartment where there was no, you know, anywhere I went, like the TVs were off, there was nobody there. It was just everywhere I went.
Did you hope that the information, your information had gotten out there?
I wasn't sure. I didn't know. I didn't know at all. I was mostly dealing with the day-to-day and survival at that point. I wasn't worried about the rest of the world.
You spoke to her about the 7 years that she spent in prison, and that's a ton of time to reflect on what she did and why she did it. What does she say about what she did 7 years ago now?
I think her beliefs to a certain extent in 2010 are the same that they are now, which is that the American government overclassifies. There's too much that is not brought into the public sphere for argument and debate. There's too much of a war on leakers and whistleblowers. So there isn't going to be a massive apology, because she still does believe in what she did. But I think as far as whether she spent all 7 years thinking about her actions, I get the sense that that wasn't the case, because she had different battles to fight. You know, now she knew that she was a woman and she was in a maximum security prison, and she had to start transitioning as best she could. So a lot of her energy and attention went to that.
Lots of people still view what Manning did as basic violation of the law and of the country. She put people's lives at risk.
She put people's lives at risk, and she, I think, understands that. But her argument would be that it was more important to bring attention to these issues than anything else.
It seems like there are still two narratives here. One is about an action that was taken. One is about an identity that changed. How does she now see herself within those two narratives?
I think that she understands the role that she's had in the trans community better in some ways than she understands her role as a whistleblower. I think that the letters and the communications that she had in the outside world for the past, let's say, 4 or 5 years as she started her transition were mostly about the trans community and were mostly from people who wanted to talk to her about it or to make her mm-hmm. part of that movement.
How many do you think you wrote back to?
700, I think.
It's an interesting question because, you know, as she becomes a public figure, which one is she going to be? I mean, can she be both? And I don't have the answer to that. I don't think she has the answer to that. But I'll be curious to see what happens over the next few years.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tell me about what's next and what you think you might want to do.
I want to see my family again. I haven't seen my niece and nephew. They were born while I was either deployed for my niece or my nephew. I was born when I was in prison. No matter what, I'm just going to be who I am, and I'm okay with that. I can be who I am now and people can see that, and I can be around people that I care about and love and so, and that support me.
Here's what else you need to know today.
Well, I think he's considering perhaps terminating the special counsel. I think he's weighing that option.
A close friend of President Trump's says Trump is considering firing Robert Mueller, the special counsel recently appointed by the Trump administration to oversee the investigation into Russian meddling in the election. The White House said the friend, conservative media executive Chris Ruddy, quote, speaks for himself, but did not dispute his account. And
this is our first cabinet meeting with the entire cabinet present.
President Trump gathered his cabinet together on Tuesday for an unusual public meeting.
I will say that never has there been a president, with few exceptions, in the case of FDR, he had a major depression to handle, who's passed more legislation, who's done more.
He then went around the room asking for a statement from each cabinet member, starting with the vice president.
Thank you, Mr. President, and just the greatest privilege of my life is to serve as vice president to a president who's keeping his word to the American people and assembling a team that's bringing real change.
One by one.
My hat's off to you for taking that stand and for sending a clear message around the world.
They paid tribute to the president in what the Times reports was an attempt to boost his mood and change the subject from investigations into Russian ties to the rest of his agenda.
On behalf of the entire senior staff around you, Mr. President, we thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda and the American people.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.